Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the OrthoBullets podcast. In today's episode, we cover the topic of subaxial cervical vertebral body fractures found under the spine section at orthobullets.com. Let's begin with a quick summary. Subaxial cervical vertebral body fractures are a subset of cervical spine injuries that consist of compression fractures, burst fractures, flexion teardrop fractures, and extension teardrop avulsion fractures. Diagnosis is made with radiographs of the cervical spine. CT scan can be helpful for fracture characterization and surgical planning. Treatment can be non-operative or surgical stabilization depending on fracture pattern, mechanical stability, and the presence of neurological deficits. Now let's get into the episode. Let's begin by describing the different types of subaxial cervical vertebral body fractures. A compression fracture is characterized by compressive failure of the anterior vertebral body without disruption of the posterior body cortex and without retropulsion into the canal. It is often associated with posterior ligamentous injury. A burst fracture is characterized by fracture extension through the posterior cortex with retropulsion into the spinal canal. It is often associated with posterior ligamentous injury. In terms of the prognosis, it is often associated with complete and incomplete spinal cord injury. In terms of the treatment, these fractures are typically unstable and usually require surgery. A flexion teardrop fracture is characterized by anterior column failure in flexion and compression, and the posterior portion of the vertebra is retropulsed posteriorly. The posterior column fails in tension, and there is a larger anterior lip fragment which may be called a quadrangular fracture. In terms of the prognosis, these are typically associated with spinal cord injury, and in terms of treatment, these are typically unstable and usually require surgery. An extension teardrop avulsion fracture is characterized by a small fleck of bone which is avulsed off the anterior end plate. It usually occurs at C2, and it must be differentiated from a true teardrop fracture. The mechanism of injury is typically due to extension, and in terms of the prognosis, this is a stable injury pattern and not associated with spinal cord injury. Treatment is typically with a cervical collar. Now let's discuss the subaxial spine injury classifications. The Allen and Ferguson classification of subaxial spine injuries is typically used for research and not in the clinical setting. It is based solely on static radiograph appearance and mechanisms of injury. There are six groups which represent a spectrum of anatomic disruption, and these include flexion compression, vertical compression, flexion distraction, extension compression, extension distraction, and lateral flexion. There is also the radiographic description classification of subaxial spine injuries. This is more commonly used in the clinical setting. These include compression fracture, burst fracture, flexion distraction injury, facet dislocation, which may be unilateral or bilateral, and facet fracture. And in terms of the presentation, remember that symptoms may include an incomplete or a complete cord injury. In terms of imaging, one must determine if there is a posterior ligamentous injury, so MRI is often important. With regards to treatment, non-operative options include collar immobilization for 6 to 12 weeks. This is indicated in stable mild compression fractures with an intact posterior ligament and no significant kyphosis. It is also indicated in anterior teardrop avulsion fractures. Another option is external halo immobilization. This is indicated only if there is a stable fracture pattern, such as with an intact posterior ligament and no significant kyphosis. Operative options include anterior decompression, corpectomy, strut graft, and fusion with instrumentation. This is indicated in compression fractures with 11 degrees of angulation or 25% loss of vertebral body height. It is also indicated in unstable burst fractures with cord compression, unstable teardrop fractures with cord compression, and when there is minimal injury to the posterior elements. Also remember that early decompression, which is defined as decompression in the first 24 hours after injury, has been shown to improve neurologic outcomes compared with delayed decompression. Another operative option is posterior decompression and fusion with instrumentation. This is indicated if there is significant injury to the posterior elements and if anterior decompression is not required. Now that we've discussed the major points relating to subaxial cervical vertebral body fractures, let's walk through some questions to apply what we've learned and get a sense of how the topic might be tested. For the first question, consider the following clinical scenario. A 22-year-old male arrives in the trauma bay 3 hours following a diving injury. He is conscious but endorsing severe neck pain. Secondary survey reveals no additional injuries. A lateral radiograph of the cervical spine demonstrates a C6 compression fracture. An MRI re-demonstrates this fracture, as well as retropulsion into the cervical canal, prevertebral swelling, and a mass effect on the cord. He is evaluated by the orthopedic resident who determines he is an ASIA C. Which of the following scenarios will result in the best chance of neurologic recovery? And the answer choices are: Choice 1, methylprednisolone bolus of 30 mg per kilogram over 15 minutes with the maintenance infusion of 5.4 mg per kilogram per hour infused for 23 hours. Choice 2, delaying surgical decompression at least 5 days to avoid a second hit by operating in the acute inflammatory window. Choice 3, administration of methylprednisolone and an urgent decompression. Choice 4, urgent surgical decompression. Or choice 5, observation in a hard collar and early mobilization. The best answer to this question is choice 4, urgent surgical decompression. The clinical presentation is consistent with a C6 burst fracture with neurologic deficits. Early decompression in the first 24 hours following traumatic spinal cord injury has been shown to improve neurologic outcomes compared with delayed management. Following a traumatic cervical spinal cord injury, the surgeon's role is to decompress the spinal cord and provide stabilization to allow for early transfers and mobilization. Multiple studies have demonstrated that early decompression is safe and is associated with the greatest chance for neurologic recovery. Delaying surgery in these patients is associated with increased pulmonary complications, decubitus ulcers, and DVT. Prior studies advocated for the use of corticosteroids to minimize secondary injury in these patients. However, this has largely been abandoned due to the potential risk of steroids and the lack of compelling evidence demonstrating improved neurologic outcomes to justify their use. The publication by Fellings et al. Conducted a multi-center prospective cohort study in adults with traumatic cervical cord injuries. They specifically sought to determine if the timing of decompression improves neurologic outcomes based on the ASIA impairment scale. They concluded that decompression within 24 hours following injury was safe and resulted in greater neurologic outcomes compared to delaying surgery. The publication by El Teco et al. Also evaluated the timing of decompression following cervical cord injuries. They performed a systematic literature review utilizing 14 preclinical and 30 clinical studies meeting their inclusion criteria. They concluded that evidence favors early decompression and that there is significant variability in defining early versus late decompression in the literature. The publication by Evanview et al. Performed a propensity score matched cohort study with data from a multi-center registry evaluating the NASCIS2 regimen of methylprednisolone use for treatment of acute spinal cord injury. Importantly, in their analysis, they controlled for anatomic level and severity of injury. They found that methylprednisolone did not improve motor recovery in this cohort, and that those who did receive an infusion had a higher rate of total complications, including urinary tract infections, decubitus ulcers, and pneumonias. The authors were in agreement with guidelines against routine administration of methylprednisolone in acute spinal cord injury. Let's also discuss why the other choices are incorrect. Choices 1 and 3. The use of steroids in spinal cord injuries are controversial due to their potential side effects and lack of clear evidence supporting neurological improvement. Thus, steroids are not advised. The NASCIS trials were 3 multi-center prospective randomized double-blinded trials that found no statistically significant differences in neurologic outcomes between methylprednisolone and placebo following spinal cord injury. Choice 2. Early decompression has been proven to be safe in prospective cohort studies. And choice 5. This injury demands early surgical decompression and stabilization to give the patient the best chance for neurologic recovery and avoiding complications associated with prolonged immobility. For the second question, consider the following clinical scenario. A lateral radiograph of the cervical spine demonstrates a quadrangular fracture pattern of C5. What is the most likely mechanism of injury? And the answer choices are: Choice 1, hyperextension. Choice 2, flexion distraction. Choice 3, flexion compression. Choice 4, rotational. Or choice 5, pure axial load. The best answer to this question is choice 3, flexion compression. A quadrangular fracture pattern of C5 is observed with flexion compression loads. Quadrangular fractures of the cervical spine are considered flexion teardrop fractures. However, they present with a larger anterior lip fragment compared to the classic teardrop fracture pattern. The radiographic findings include a quadrangular-shaped fragment from the anterior one-third of the vertebral body with significant posterior vertebral subluxation, angular kyphosis, and an increased interspinous space with facet subluxation due to disruption of the posterior elements. These are unstable fractures and almost always require anterior and posterior stabilization. The publication by Moore et al. Studied the reliability of the cervical spine injury severity score to measure stability after cervical spine trauma. The classification system is based on morphologic descriptions and, secondly, on stability based on a quantifiable value. They showed that cervical spine injury severity score had excellent reliability with intra-observer intra-class correlation coefficients greater than 0.97 and inter-observer ICC greater than 0.88. The publication by Vaccaro et al. Published the subaxial cervical spine injury classification system. This system involves three main categories: injury morphology, discoligamentous complex, and neurologic status. The overall injury severity score is obtained by summing the scores from each category. They propose that SLIC less than 4 can be treated non-operatively. The publication by Allen et al. Published the classification system of cervical spine injuries, which breaks injuries of the subaxial spine into 6 phylogenetic groups based on mechanism of injury. These include flexion compression, vertical compression, flexion distraction, extension compression, extension distraction, and lateral flexion. Facet dislocation is caused by flexion distraction force. Let's also discuss why the other choices are incorrect. Choice 1, hyperextension injuries usually result in central cord injuries. Choice 2, flexion distraction injuries usually result in facet dislocations. Choice 4, rotational injuries will usually cause soft tissue injury or high cervical injury. And choice 5, pure axial load will usually result in cervical burst fractures. That's all for this review about subaxial cervical vertebral body fractures. We hope that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session from OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. As a reminder, you can follow along with these podcast episodes by reviewing the topics directly on orthobullets.com. You can listen to these episodes on the OrthoBullets website or phone app while reading through the topic. If the OrthoBullets podcast has been valuable to you, we'd be thrilled if you consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow, right here, on the OrthoBullets podcast.